Welcome to Dispatches, a shorter podcast from the old front line and me, military historian Paul Reed. In the familiar landscape of Picardy, there is also a forgotten Somme. And today we walk one part of it at Red Ann Ridge. One of the many things that I love about the Somme battlefields of the Great War are those many quiet corners where you can connect with the history of the conflict on a wide open landscape dotted with the beacons of that war, the silent cities, the cemeteries. You can kind of get lost in those landscapes of the Somme and indeed many battlefields along the Western Front. One such place that I never tire of walking in those Somme battlefields, but which for a number of reasons never seems to get that many visitors, is the Red Ann Ridge. Located between the villages of Beaumont Hamel and Sayre, two household names from 1916 and the Battle of the Somme, it isn't as well known as the events that took place there, particularly at the beginning of the battle, but yet it was one of the greatest killing fields on that first day of the Somme, 1st of July 1916. So where are we for this Dispatches, a glimpse of the battlefields of the Red Ann Ridge? We've just walked up the sunken lane, the famous sunken lane between Auchonvilliers, Ocean Villas, and Beaumont Hamel. This was in no man's land at the time of the Battle of the Somme, an annex by the Lancashire Fusiliers and the Brigade Trench Mortars and Machine Guns, and where Geoffrey Malins filmed before they went over the top at 7:30 that morning. But it's not that story that we're going to look at in this podcast. We're walking up the sunken lane to where it curves and arches towards another track that goes from left to right in front of us, and that's Watling Streets on the maps. All of these little lanes and pathways were given a name on the trench maps of the Great War so that they could be identified in messages and communiques that were sent from the battlefield. And where we're standing as these two tracks meet is roughly in the area of no man's land as of the 1st of July 1916. What can we see from here? Well, if we for a minute turn round and look back down the sunken lane, we can see the top of the Celtic Cross of the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders Memorial. We can look across that landscape. Beaumont Hamel British Cemetery is just beneath us. And there, on the rising ground of the next ridge, the Hawthorne Ridge, we can see the trees of the Hawthorne Mine Crater. To our right is the church spire of Auchonvilliers, which we've mentioned, Ocean Villas, the village just behind the British front line. And to our left, the church spire sitting in a little hollow of the village of Beaumont Hamel, which was behind the German front line. Those positions at Beaumont Hamel were part of the defences of the 26th Reserve Division, a Württemberg unit that had been on the Somme since the autumn of 1914 and had worked on and perfected the defences here throughout that period since. On the other side of No Man's Land were the British troops that had been assembled for this battle. On the eve of the attack in late June 1916, these were a mixture of men who had fought in some of the early battles of the war on the Western Front. Some had fought at Gallipoli in 1915, and others had just joined their units as reinforcements from reserve battalions coming out to replace the losses in those earlier battles. And then when we turn round and look up to the join of the track in front of us, we can see the sloping ground moving up across the top of a ridge, the Red Ann Ridge. And to our right, the northern part of Beaumont Hamel, the mushroom-shaped water tower that's there, and the road that runs past it that weaves up over this landscape, past the three cemeteries that are going to form part of our walk, and drops down onto the Arras Road near to the hamlet of Sayre, where the Powell's battalions fought on that first day of the Somme, a subject that we've discussed in previous podcasts. So we're going to concentrate on this little bit of ground now that is between the village of Beaumont Hamel and the village of Sayre, a bit of a forgotten bit of the 1st of July 1916 story in many ways. And if we're standing here where these two tracks come together and we're in no man's land, if we look to our right towards that road near the water tower, we're looking towards the German positions, and to our left, we're looking towards where the British trenches ran. How did this part of the front initially form? Well, of course, at the beginning of the conflict, this was an area where the French army met the Germans. In those great advances of the German army in the summer and towards the autumn of 1914, those armies clashed north of Paris and fought right across this Somme landscape, creating the line that would form the forward positions that would be so fought over 2 years later in the Battle of the Somme in 1916. And with those positions established by the autumn of 1914, both sides dug in, the French on their side of the battlefield and the Germans on theirs. And this area around Beaumont Hamel and up towards Sayre, particularly at Sayre in 1915, in the June 1915 actions there, saw some pretty heavy fighting, but otherwise areas like this were kind of all quiet on the Western Front. British units came here in that summer of 1915 when the British Army began to extend its line south and take over more and more parts of the Western Front. And the 4th Division, which was a regular army division that had just taken part in the Second Battle of Ypres, where its men had faced gas, poison gas for the first time, and concerted German attacks, came down here, which to them must have felt like a holiday compared to the experiences that they'd had at Ypres in April and May of 1915. They got here in that summer, they took over trenches from the French. When you read some of their war diaries, they talk about dirty trenches and a lot of work having to take place to get those trenches kind of up to a British standard. And then the Ulster Division, the 36th Ulster Division, part of the new army, Kitchener's army, having trained, having come to Britain, having crossed to France, this was part of the sector that they served in late 1915 when they first came to France, through to the early part of 1916 before they moved to the other side of the Ancre Valley and famously took over those trenches around Thiepval Wood in preparation for their assault on the Schwaben Redoubt and the ground beyond in those early stages of the Battle of the Somme. The Ulstermen spent a lot of time up here in that winter of 1915-16, and there was an incident up here involving the 9th Battalion of the Royal Irish Rifles, commanded by Lieutenant Colonel F.P. Crozier. Crozier was an interesting character. He wrote several books about his war experiences, A Brass Hat in No Man's Land, and one with the title The Men I Killed, which kind of gives you a bit of an insight into his character. One soldier described him as a cruel martinet, and Crozier, the colonel, enlisted a young soldier as the battalion was being formed who had the same name as him, James Crozier, who was an underage Belfast ship worker, aged only 16. And when Crozier Senior took him into the army, he promised his mother, "Do not worry, I will look after him and see that no harm comes to him." But James Crozier was a young boy, yet to really tread the path of a normal life, thrown from school into ship working and then into the army as a volunteer. His experiences on the Western Front, even in those just early months when the Ulster Division was just holding the line here, was difficult for him, as it was for many soldiers, but he didn't have the maturity to deal with it. And after his experiences up here on the Red Ann Ridge during that so-called quiet period, he deserted and was arrested and tried by a field general court-martial for desertion, found guilty and subsequently executed at Mahé-Mahé on the 27th of February 1916 in a walled garden. The place where he was shot is still there. It's a kind of a chateau building with a high wall around it and a part of a sunken lane. And Colonel Crozier had the men line up in that lane. They couldn't see the execution, but they could hear it, which possibly made that experience a lot worse for the men who were present. We've spoken about Shot at Dawn before, but this is not one of the cases that is clear cut, and Crozier, Colonel Crozier, having promised that boy's mother he'd look after, was the one who really sealed his fate. And Crozier later stated, "When it fell to my lot to recommend the carrying out or remitting of the death sentence, I invariably recommended the carrying out of the extreme penalty, because I expected to be shot myself if I ran away." Now, the story probably deserves his own podcast, and there's a lot of material out there about James Crozier. Buried in the grounds of that building where he was shot, his grave was moved post-war to the Sucre Cemetery up at Collincamps, and I know many people visit it each year. But that was one episode up on the Redan Ridge during the lead-up to the Battle of the Somme. On the 1st of July 1916, this was an area where those units of the 4th Division, who had initially taken over this sector, moved around a bit, the Ulster Division had relieved them, then they'd come back to this sector for it to be theirs in the preparation for the big push that was coming. They found themselves kind of sandwiched between the 29th Division to the south, who had fought at Gallipoli in 1915, and the 31st Division, the Powell's Division, with men from Barnsley and Bradford and Leeds and Sheffield and so many other places besides, who had been on the Suez Canal and were now here on the Western Front. They've kind of found themselves sandwiched between those. And the division was a very different division to the unit that had gone to war in August 1914. This was a regular army division, but there were very few regular soldiers left in the ranks of the units within it. It had seen systematic change during that period with the arrival of reservists and then war volunteers to replace the losses, particularly after the Second Battle of Ypres in 1915. And gradually during that period, when it arrived on the Somme up to the attack here on the 1st of July, its battalions had been built back up to some kind of strength. When we look at the story of what happened here on the Redan Ridge on the 1st of July, we look at the sources that are there, the unit histories, the official history, war diaries, and it tells us that actually the bombardment here had done its job. The wire was cut, the German frontline trenches were damaged by the bombardment, smashed up in quite a few places, but, and it's a big but, the support line and the dugouts beneath that support line were largely untouched by the shelling. So the German garrison who was here, from the Reserve Infantry Regiment number 121, who were a Württemberg unit, part of that 26th Reserve Division, recruited the unit in Stuttgart, were pretty much intact, sheltering down in those deep dugouts from the trommel fire, the drum fire that the British had lain down on their positions, but they'd not suffered significant casualties. So when 0 hour came, those men, untouched really by the bombardment, could crawl out of those deep dugouts, get up into the smash front line positions, but more importantly, on that beautiful summer's day of the 1st of July, now have perfect visibility with their weapons, their machine guns and their rifle teams across that battlefield towards where their Tommies, the British, would be coming from. When we look at the composition of the 4th Division units that attacked here on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, and we don't need to discuss every single one of them, but the division was kind of broken in half, with one part of its attack on the other side of the hill from where we are now, down towards that area of the Arras Road. They were assaulting a German position known as the Quadrilateral to the British, or the Heidenkopf, the Heathen's Head, to the Germans. That fighting is slightly out of the area where we are on this walk. The rest of the division were making their advance from left to right in front of us across this Redan Ridge. As 0 hour approached, the German machine guns were already laying down heavy fire into no man's land, which again kind of emphasises just how many survivors there'd been from the bombardment. The physical damage to the trenches was one thing, but if the garrison survived, then the outcome of some of these battles really under these circumstances was going to be pretty much guaranteed. And they had then signalled back those survivors to their gun batteries into pre-registered areas where artillery fire could be brought down to defend their positions. So shells were dropping into no man's land too, in expectation of a British assault, and also into the forward British positions, causing casualties to the men assembling to go up the ladders and go out into no man's land. And what it created in the area immediately in front of the British forward positions was what one account called a wilderness of shell holes, which of course immediately created an obstacle that these men had to cross that was not part of their expected plan. In this area, the 1st Battalion, the East Lancashire Regiment, and the 1st Rifle Brigade walked out of their trenches into no man's land, into this wall of fire, from the machine guns firing from different directions, enfilading them, firing into the sides of the attack, causing maximum damage from the machine gun fire, and then shells dropping into no man's land and the area of the assault, with minenwerfers, trench mortars dropping in there too, causing merry hell amongst those assault battalions. And one quote says, "The machine guns not only shot down the leading battalions, but slaughtered the supporting ones and prevented reinforcements and supplies from crossing no man's land." So very quickly here, the Reserve Infantry Regiment number 121 are able to lay down defensive fire and pretty much knock this British assault for six as it tries to cross the battlefield. But the wire in front of the German trenches was cut. Here the shrapnel had done its job, it cut the wire. And here and there, small parties of men survived the machine gun fire, survived the shell fire, and got into the German trenches. Some of them even reaching the support lines, working their way up through communication trenches into the next German position, following the orders they've been given to push on, keep pushing on. But those men were cut off, surrounded, killed, or taken prisoner of war. Very few, if any, of those ever returned. The follow-up waves that were coming up behind them then got pinned down in shell holes in no man's land because of all this fire. And the losses amongst all of the units that went forward here were very heavy, particularly amongst officers. These were regular units. Often they kind of followed the tradition of the colonel, the battalion commander being out in front with the adjutant and the second in command and the company commanders in front of their companies, as was very common on the 1st of July. And so you see the whole command structure of some of these units break down very quickly when they become some of the very first casualties. So in several battalions, they lost their commanding officer. And on the other side of the hill, the brigade advancing there lost their brigadier, Brigadier General Bertie Prowse, who had come up from a company commander to a battalion commander to now a brigade commander since the beginning of the war, and was mortally wounded here on the 1st of July, dying of his wounds that evening, becoming the most senior British officer to become a casualty on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. So it wasn't just ordinary Tommies who became casualties that day. One party of men, largely from the 2nd Battalion, the Essex Regiment, who was in one of the follow-up attacks, broke through the trench system in this area of the Red Ann Ridge to ground south of the village of Sayre. Again, they kind of followed through their orders to push on, irrespective of what was happening around them. No other battalion, no other men in any significant numbers from any other unit had got that far, but these lads of the 2nd Essex managed to do that, and of course they found themselves completely cut off there, with no friendly forces close by, the enemy to the north in Sayre Village, the enemy to the east towards Puisieux, to the south at Beaumont Hamel, and now also behind them. Very quickly they got cut off and surrounded, and they were pinned by enemy fire from all directions, attacked from the rear, their positions were overrun, and none of them were seen again. All of those men became casualties, were either killed or wounded and taken prisoner. For the 4th Division that attacked across that Red Ann Ridge on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, this was a catastrophic disaster. Battalion after battalion had gone forward, attached units to them from the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, again on the other side of the hill, had gone forward and taken heavy losses too. And there was very little, if anything, in most places to show for what had happened that day. Their casualties were staggering. Over 5,700 casualties in this area of the battlefield where we are now, from the crest of this hill down to the Arras Road just beyond. 5,700 casualties. Now, there were 57,000 casualties killed, wounded and missing on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. So this area where we are now, 10% of those casualties were suffered here. So in that kind of buffer zone between two more famous attacks, this was just as deadly a battlefield on the 1st of July 1916. It meant that this gentle rise that we see before us today and these open fields with the skylarks above were absolute killing fields more than a century ago. And one of the veterans that I interviewed back in the 1980s, who I've mentioned on this podcast quite a few times, was George Butler. He was a teenage Tommy who had joined the regular army in the Edwardian period, aged just 12, had gone up through the ranks, become a boy soldier, and then a private soldier, and was an expert machine gunner when the war broke out, and went overseas eventually in early 1915 to join his battalion in the Lancashire Fusiliers, served with them at Ypres, and when the machine gun corps was formed, he became one of its first volunteers, and he served here with the brigade machine gun company in the assault across this part of the ridge where we're standing now. Now, out of all the battles that George took part in, and he was at Ypres, 1915, during the gas attack, for example, and then later on at Arras, at Phampoo, at Ypres again, and then up on the dunes near Newport, and then badly wounded in the Battle of Lys in April 1918, the battle he spoke the least about was this one here at Sayre. He was quite dismissive of it. He recounted how they took their machine guns over, aiming to set them up to give covering fire to the attacking troops, but the wall of fire that they received just wasn't possible. Now, I recently discovered that George's memoirs that he wrote for Lynn MacDonald when she was interviewing veterans, she'd contacted him when he was living somewhere else, and he prepared this kind of memoir that he formalised into a typed account, and he gave it to her. And he always told me this. He didn't have a copy of it himself, and I've never seen one, but I've now discovered that there is a copy, perhaps the copy, in the archives of the Imperial War Museum. So that's on my radar to go up and have a look at soon, and possibly to do a kind of a mini podcast about George Butler based on some of the more detailed written account that he left behind, as well as what I remember from our interviews. And I do have some recordings of George, but it's one of those processes that I haven't quite got round to actually kind of digitising that yet, but I will do. So George Butler was here, and I kind of think of him, you know, it's not untypical of some of the men who were in this unit. He was still a young soldier. He was only 18 when he was here, but he was by this stage quite a senior, experienced soldier. There are photographs of him taken just before this battle where all the men in his unit are around him, and there he is with his young, fresh face, but he looks a bit of a tough cookie. And a tough cookie he was, because his soldiering went on long beyond the Great War. So this is a place, whenever I walk the Red Ant Ridge, I always think of George Butler up here with his machine gun team on the first day of the Somme. Not far away from him was a man who would be recognised for his bravery here that day, one of many that would be decorated with gallantry awards for the fighting that took place here on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And that was drummer Walter Ritchie of the 2nd Battalion Seaforth Highlanders. His unit was in one of the follow-up waves like the Essex, and he was playing his drum on the parapet of the British trenches to encourage the men, although some of the accounts say that he wasn't drumming, he was blowing a bugle. But whatever he was doing, as a drummer, that was his official rank, he rallied the men in his area and sounded the charge as bullets and shrapnel whizzed past him. And there's a kind of a bit of a parallel with him and George Butler, in that they were both pre-war regular soldiers and had both joined the army as young men, as boys. Walter Ritchie had joined at age 16 in 1908, and he too went on to serve beyond the Great War, living to a ripe old age and dying just after the 50th anniversary of the Great War, when he was by then in his 70s. So after the terrible casualties here on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, what happened in this sector? The Battle of the Somme rolled on, but there was no fighting here. This became one part of the Somme front where things remained static again until later on in the battle. And unit after unit passed through here during that July, August, September and October period. Units that were coming to the Somme to acclimatise to the conditions on the Somme before being pitched into an attack somewhere often came to places like this, and likewise after they'd been in an attack at Delville Wood or Jonchy or Guimont or somewhere like that, they were often pulled out of the line and sent to a slightly quieter, in inverted commas, part of the Somme before they were moved to another sector. As we've discussed a few times on the podcast, the British kind of like to move units around much more than other armies. So the fighting here didn't really return until the end of the Battle of the Somme, with what was called the Battle of the Ancre, which began on the 13th of November 1916. And in this area, where we're standing with the ridge ahead of us, units of the 2nd Division, so another regular army division that had been out since the very beginning of the war, and likewise had suffered a lot of casualties, so few of its regular soldiers were left, and quite a few of its regular battalions had been replaced with wartime units. And one of those was the 22nd Battalion of the Royal Fusiliers, the Kensingtons. So this was a Kitchener's army, a new army battalion formed in London, borough of Kensington, and known as the Kensingtons, different to the 13th Battalion, the London Regiment, that was also known as the Kensingtons. That's where kind of regimental details can get quite confusing, really, at times. But the 22nd Royal Fusiliers is an interesting battalion, very good little battalion history, quite a few accounts of guys that were in it. And one soldier in particular that ties us to this part of the Somme landscape was one of the men who fought and sadly died here, and that was Hector Hugh Munro, H.H. Munro. H.H. Munro was a writer, better known under his pen name of Sarki. Munro was born in Burma, where his father was an inspector in the Indian police, and he returned to Britain after his mother died when he was only a young child, and brought up by his grandmother and his aunts. Based in London, he wrote short stories which had a massive following in the Edwardian period. Most people have probably never heard of Sarki or H.H. Munro today, but he had a big following in those years before the Great War. And when he joined up, given his kind of background and his education and the fact that he was a writer, he could have easily have applied and been given a commission as an officer, but he turned that down and he initially joined the King Edward's Horse, which was a wartime raise unit, a cavalry unit that was formed from men who had come from Britain's dominion nations but were in Britain when the war broke out and could enlist in that unit. And so having been born in Burma, he qualified to join the King Edward's Horse. Now, they eventually went overseas, but he was then transferred to the 22nd Royal Fusiliers, and he remained in the ranks. He didn't serve as an officer. And he wrote quite a lot of material about his experiences on the Western Front, some of which survives. But sadly, this is the battlefield where he was killed. Not in the opening attack on the 13th of November. He was killed once the battalion had gone forward and the position was established. He died here on the 14th of November, the next day, when it is said that his last words were, "Put that bloody cigarette out," and that was it, lights out for H.H. Munro, for Sarki. While little known today, he was an immensely important early 20th century writer, and as a gay man, he spent a lot of time in pre-war France, where homosexuality was not a criminal offence as it was in Britain. So as we can see, Munro was a fascinating and absorbing character. He wrote quite a lot about birds on the Western Front, which of course is one thing that draws me to his writing. And we've covered birds on the Western Front in a previous podcast, and I often speak about them. But to give you some idea of the kind of writing that he left behind, this is one of an excerpt from one of his accounts of talking about owls on the battlefield and how they were thriving. "Considering the enormous economic dislocation which the war operations have caused in the regions where the campaign is raging, there seems to be very little corresponding disturbance in the bird life of the same districts. Rats and mice have mobilised and swarmed into the fighting line, and there has been a partial mobilisation of owls, particularly barn owls, following in the wake of the mice and making laudable efforts to thin out their numbers. What success attends their hunting, one cannot estimate. There are always sufficient mice left over to popularise one's dugout and make a parade ground and race course of one's face at night. In the matter of nesting accommodation, the barn owls are very well provided for. Most of the still intact barns in the war zone are requisitioned for billeting purposes, but there is a wealth of ruined houses, whole streets and clusters of them, such as can hardly have been available at any previous moment of the world's history. So from that, we kind of see Munro testifying to what we spoke about in the podcast on birds on the Western Front, how wildlife was thriving under those conditions, the curious conditions caused by the war itself. Sadly, there's no grave to visit for Munro. Most likely he was buried on the battlefield and later fighting destroyed whatever cross, whatever burial ground had been made for him. And today he has no known grave and is commemorated on the Royal Fusilier panels of the Tjapvaal Memorial to the Missing. So we're going to move off of our junction of tracks now and head down Watling Street, which takes us across No Man's Land to where we come to the first of the three Redan Ridge cemeteries that are here. These three cemeteries are numbered Redan Ridge numbers 1, 2 and 3, understandably, but we're going to visit Redan Ridge number 2 first because that's where it is on this part of the landscape. There's a common factor in all of these three cemeteries, how they were made. And the original cemetery registers say the cemeteries were made by the 5th Corps in the spring of 1917 when these battlefields were cleared. So what does that mean? Well, the two ends of the Battle of the Somme were fought here, the attack on the 1st of July, the assault on the 13th of November, which was a much more successful attack that pushed the Germans back and this ground was captured, but it was still an active battlefield. And it wasn't until the Germans withdrew to the Hindenburg Line in early 1917, and this became an area behind the battlefield, behind the front lines, that it could be properly cleared. So burial parties from burial units within that 5th Corps, which was an amalgamation of different divisions, were sent out onto these battlefields to create battlefield cemeteries, find the dead and bury them. And in many cases, they found men hanging on the wire, lying in front of the German trenches, in shell holes, in no man's land, in rough field graves, often communal burials where men had been buried together in one shell hole or a bit of a trench. And then they created the cemeteries that we see on this landscape today. And there are a lot of this type of cemetery in this northern part of the Somme battlefields. Quite a few up at Serre from the Pows, here at Redan Ridge, and if we look back in the other direction towards Beaumont Hamel and beyond, we see the Hawthorne Ridge cemeteries, which are likewise collective burials made when the ground was cleared later on in the fighting. So when we get to Redan number 2 and we go up a little grass path to get to it and go through the gate, it's kind of a wedge-shaped cemetery with several rows of graves, and we're about 100 yards west of the German front line of the 1st of July. There are 279 burials in this cemetery, which is a lot more than it kind of looks like when you go through the gate. And of those, 124 are unidentified. All of the burials here date from either July or November of 1916 and are from the principal units that fought in this part of the battlefield. Most of them from the 2nd and 4th Divisions, from those two bookends of the Battle of the Somme, and a few from the 29th Division who attacked in the area of the Sunken Lane and beyond, who were found and then moved up as part of the burial details that swept through here to clear this battlefield in 1917. What do the headstones tell us, though, when we walk into a cemetery like this? Well, they're all close together, and in some cases there are more than one name on a headstone, which immediately tells us that we are looking at a collective, not quite a mass grave, but a collective grave of men buried when a battlefield has been cleared. Remains have been out in the open for a very long time. We can kind of imagine what that has done. And then they're buried in these proper cemeteries, but in the confines of how they can be buried in these collective graves. So when we see this headstones close together, multiple names, we always know that we're looking at a kind of collective stroke mass burial, depending on the circumstances. And when we look at the cap badges of the units that we can see represented on the graves, we see a dominance of the Hampshire Regiment, 1st Battalion, The Hampshire Regiment fought here on the first day of the Battle of the Somme. And amongst the Greys, we find three drummers that nicely connects us to drummer Ritchie, who was awarded the Victoria Cross for his bravery in the fighting here. One drummer from the Hampshire Regiment and two from the Lancashire Fusiliers. Not as famous as drummer Ritchie and his long military career and his VC, but nevertheless, they kind of testify to the regular nature of the units that were here, because that rank of drummer is something that you see less and less as the war goes on. From Renan Ridge number 2, we return via the grass path to the track, and we walk up towards that mushroom-shaped water tower, and we reach a main road there that runs from Beaumont Hamel up towards Sayre, and we turn left and walk up a little way. We can see the rising ground beyond us. And if we look across to our right, we can see another collection of battlefield cemeteries out there from the next stage of the November 1916 fighting. Another walk for another day. But that brings us to a calvary by the side of the road, where the road continues up over the crest of the Red Ann Ridge and a track goes off to the left. And that calvary kind of focuses your eye on the next cemetery, which is Red Ann Ridge number 3, which is up the side of a bank of what is essentially a sunken lane here. This sits amongst the old German trenches held by the Reserve Infantry Regiment number 121 on the first day of the Somme and taken in the November 1916 fighting. It's a smaller battlefield cemetery, and there are 67 graves here, 13 of which were destroyed by shell fire in the later fighting and are now marked by special memorials. So there are headstones to those men in there, but there is no burial underneath them. They're known to be buried in the confines of the cemetery, but the exact location of their grave is not known. And of the 67 burials, 34 of them, so pretty much half of them, are unidentified. Almost all of the dead in here are from the 2nd Division, so this is a slightly different kind of cemetery where it's dominated by the later fighting of November 1916. And from here on this kind of high bank, we can see right across towards where that final attack went in, northeast of Beaumont Hamel. And we can also see, as we look up towards Sayre, we can see the ground where war poet Wilfred Owen was in his Somme experiences in early of 1917. But again, that is a story for another day. From Red Ann Ridge number 3, we return to the sunken lane and the track, and that takes us up right onto the crest of the Red Ann Ridge here, and to an area where for many, many years there were Red Ann Ridge mine craters. This was an area of mining activity as well, where the lines got very close and both sides went under the battlefields, the French and the Germans, and then later the British too. And when I first came to the Somme in the 80s and came up here, this was an area where those craters could be visibly seen. Many of them were water-filled craters on this high point, which I think surprised quite a lot of people. But gradually they got filled in by the farmers and they were used as a rubbish dump. And there's only a kind of slight dip in the ground now where the craters were once located. And there we find a track taking us off to the final of these three Red Ann Ridge cemeteries that we're seeing, Red Ann Ridge number 1, which is on the very top of the ridge and now cleared, as it has been in recent years, of undergrowth and some of its trees. It's a very exposed cemetery in many ways. It sits proud on this part of the landscape, very much acting as a beacon to the Great War here. And in this one, there's 154 burials, of which 74 are unnamed. So again, pretty much half of them. Almost all of these are from the 4th Division, who fell on the 1st of July, and a few from the 2nd Division on the 13th of November, including quite a lot of Royal Fusiliers from H.H. Munro's battalion. Is Sarkey amongst the unknowns in here? I mean, we will never know. But it's a place where you can come to remember H.H. Munro and men like him. We see from here a wide vista of the Somme. In the very distance, we can see Chapvale, for example, where Munro is commemorated, and the wider expanse of the Somme battlefields. Sit here for a while on the base of the Cross of Sacrifice with a map. You can really orientate yourself across this northern part of the Somme landscape. And I've stood here on many an evening as the sun has crept low often bright and orange across this landscape of the Somme battlefields. And here you feel you are on part of the forgotten Somme, a term that we've spoken about a few times on this podcast. The power of these vast open fields is immense. And these beacons, these comrade cemeteries, where men who fought and fell together are buried, give voice to an otherwise silent place, except around us, faintly in the distance, the rumblings of a modern world. Redan Ridge can be passed through in an instant, in just minutes, but yet it holds so much history and brings together so many of the familiar crisscross pathways of those battles from more than a century ago. It reminds us that even in places we know so well, there are new pages to turn, new lanes to walk along that never-ending old front line. You've been listening to Dispatches, part of the Old Front Line podcast, with me, military historian Paul Reed. If you've enjoyed this episode, please think about leaving a review on your favourite podcast platform, giving us a rating, and leaving a comment on the podcast website, oldfrontline.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter, and if you want to support the podcast, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/oldfrontline, or buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Thanks for listening, and see you again soon.